Chapter 5. Germany, Adolf Hitler, and National Socialism. In the study of the whole historical movement of the white race struggling to free itself from under the heel of Jewish tyranny, the name of Adolf Hitler shines forth as the brightest meteor to flash through the heavens since the beginning of history. No doubt, the white race will produce even greater men in the future, but it is my considered opinion that Adolf Hitler stands head and shoulders above any other man as the greatest white leader the white race has ever produced and the greatest white man that ever lived. This may sound as an overly extravagant evaluation, but if so, no man deserved it more, nor any man come by it more honestly. The contribution that this great white man made towards striking a resounding blow for the cause of the white race and accomplishing a near breakthrough in smashing the Jewish conspiracy will go down in history as one of the most heroic battles in the history of mankind. When we consider what little he had to start with, what little he had to work with, how tremendous were the obstacles that he had to overcome, the Herculean efforts that were expended, and the heroic fight that was waged, we can safely say, without contradiction, that in the words of William Shakespeare, the elements so mixed in him that nature might stand up and say to all the world, this was a man. Indeed, Adolf Hitler was not only the epitome of a man, but he best represented those qualities that shine forth in the white race: honor, heroism, genius, creativity, leadership, an artistic spirit, and above all, the readiness to sacrifice himself for the good of his race. But for this one man, undoubtedly Germany would have been overwhelmingly communized in the early 30s, since Germany is the key and the anchor nation in the heart of Europe. Undoubtedly, in short order, the entire continent would have fallen victim to Jewish Marxist communism. Certainly, if Hitler and the new National Socialist movement that he founded had not saved Germany, Spain also would have fallen victim to this treacherous cancer. Undoubtedly, the vicious and destructive Spanish Civil War would never have turned out to be a victory for the fighters against Jewish communism. With Spain and Germany gone, in short order, a sick and dissipated France, already infected with the Marxist virus, would have succumbed. With Spain, France, and Germany on the one side, and communist Russia on the other side, it is unthinkable that the Balkan countries of Romania, Czechoslovakia, and the others would have put up any worthwhile resistance in the Jewish onslaught to enslave Europe. With the continent gone, the small island kingdom of Great Britain, itself long a citadel of Jewish money power, would shortly have fallen like an overripe tomato. Certainly fascist Italy would have shortly crumbled under military invasion if necessary, and the few other small and relatively weak countries, such as the Scandinavian countries and Greece, would have offered no obstacle whatsoever. So it can be readily seen that if it had not been for the advent of Adolf Hitler, Europe, by the 1930s, would have been totally crushed in the giant maws of Jewish communism. Undoubtedly, by the middle 30s, all of Europe would have been in the grip of this fiendish pestilence that we today call communism. But is really the Jewish program for the destruction of the white race and its civilization? Without a doubt, America, who has within its environs more Jews than any other country in the world, and who supplied the money, the material, the production of the armaments of war, certainly America would not have resisted the final onslaught of this cancer. It is therefore fairly safe to say, but for the grace of a kindly providence and the appearance of Adolf Hitler on the scene of world history, today, you and I would be living under a complete nightmare, such as has darkened the lights throughout Russia and Eastern Europe today. But, you might say, Adolf Hitler was destroyed, Germany was utterly defeated, and National Socialism was completely crushed, without a vestige remaining. It is true, Adolf Hitler is dead. It is true, Germany was utterly vanquished and left a mass of rubble. It is true that National Socialism was eradicated as a political party in Germany. So what has Adolf Hitler done for us, for the white race? Well, he has done a great deal. For one thing, he has bought us time. As we stated previously, undoubtedly, by the end of the 1930s, all of Europe, and most likely the whole world, would be lying crushed and gutted, cowering at the feet of the diabolical Jewish monster, Jewish communism. Adolf Hitler did not die in vain. He died for his beloved white race, including you and me. He bought us at least 50 years of time, in which we could rally ourselves and make a great final effort to victoriously crush the monster that is now still clutching at our throat. Yes, he bought us time, and he did more than that. He gave us a sense of direction, and he gave us a great cause, and an inspiring example to strive for. He challenged this vile evil, and he showed us all that this monstrous world plague could be challenged and could be overcome. In fact, he came marvelously close to winning the battle in his own time. He gave us hope, he gave us an example, and he gave us an ideology to fight for. In clear lines, he delineated the enemy, and he set forth the goal. He established the first white government that was based on a racial foundation. Adolf Hitler did not die in vain. From his ashes shall rise a phoenix right in the heart of America that will spring to life again and take up the battle to save not only America, but to save the white race for the entire world. The life story of Adolf Hitler undoubtedly constitutes the most fantastic, true romance of any story that has ever been written in the history of mankind. It is a true story, not a fantasy conjured in the minds of storytellers. It is a great epic that has occurred within this present century, and we can be proud that it has happened in our own time. To understand the story of Adolf Hitler, we must first of all reach back into the history of Germany itself, and even before that, the story of the German people. Anyone who studies the outcroppings of genius in the progress of the white race cannot help but be impressed by the number of German names that predominate in any such list. Whether it be the field of music, or in the field of literature, or in the field of chemistry, or mathematics, or in the field of inventions, or in the field of physics, the contributions of genius in all these fields from the German people have been rich indeed. Not only that, but the German people embody all those qualities that are the pride of the white race. They are hard-working, productive, energetic, brave fighters, and above all, tremendously creative. On the other hand, they also possess that fatal flaw that is so characteristic of the white race. They are so prone to squabbling and fighting amongst themselves, and furthermore, have a fatal susceptibility to Jewish propaganda. For centuries, not only did the Germans possess the best qualities of the Nordic blood within the white race, but they were located in the heart of geographic Europe, and therefore in any European development were the key element. Why then, it might well be asked, did Germany lag behind France, Spain, and England in the race for colonies, and in fact, in the establishment of a world empire? And the answer lies in its Achilles heel, namely, a house divided against itself cannot endure. In no major nation has there been so much divisiveness and so much internal and fraternal bickering as among the German people. Thus it was until that great leader, Adolf Hitler, came along. Since the days of the Romans, through the reign of Charlemagne, and for centuries thereafter, Germany has been split into small principalities, dukedoms, and kingdoms. Probably not since the days of the fall of Babylon have a people been so infested with Jewish parasites as were the little fiefs, dukedoms, and principalities of Germany. Upon these, the Jews continually fasten themselves, and upon their rulers, loaning them money, corrupting their morals, and stirring up wars. Nevertheless, by the 16th century, it became evident that the Germans were becoming a major power in the heart of Europe, and would by their numbers, their industry, and their energy soon master the continent of Europe, if left unchecked. If there is one thing that the Jews cannot and will not tolerate, if they can help it, it is that great white people like the Germans unite and predominate in world politics. It was therefore at this time that the Jews promoted what has been known in history as the Great Schism. The Jew hurled the Protestant Reformation into the face of white Europe, and with it a fratricidal convulsion on an unprecedented scale. The Jews, who created Christianity in the first place, and dominated and controlled it for the first 1500 years through the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church, had thoroughly corrupted the church to the point where the average believer was so completely sickened and nauseated by the excesses of the church leadership that he was ready to revolt. The Jews then brought forth a puppet to lead the revolt against the church that was to split wide open the white world, all the way from Germany to Sweden to France and England. Amongst no people were the ensuing convulsions greater than amongst the German people. After smouldering for approximately a century, this convulsion burst forth into a flaming struggle amongst the German people. It was called the 30 Years' War. Between 1618 and 1648, a devastating 30 years. The German people hacked each other to pieces and tore themselves apart. This tragic convulsion, when it was finally over, left the German people torn and bleeding, with 5/6 of all their property and buildings destroyed, and the population decimated. When the Treaty of Westphalia finally ended this tragic and bitter fratricide, it was not the German people who wrote the terms of that treaty, but the surrounding outside powers who dictated the terms to the victims. Needless to say, the perfidious Jew had his hand in it again, and the last thing in the world that he wanted was to see a strong, united Germany. What he structured was a resumption of the divided dukedoms and principalities that it had before the suicidal war began. But it was now further saddled with the added problem of being half Catholic and half Protestant. Not only that, but the war had engendered a rich harvest of hatreds amongst the Germans themselves that were not too much unlike those which the Jew fostered between the North and the South of the United States, when they plunged our unfortunate country into the Civil War. This bloody and grueling exercise in self-destruction set the German people back perhaps 300 years in the development of their nationhood, and it cost them world leadership. It was pretty well the situation of the German people until the advent of Bismarck, who united the petty German states, but successfully waged war against the Germans of Austria, and soundly defeated them at the Battle of Königgrätz in 1866. This battle, and the victorious war against the French of 1870, united the German states under the leadership of Prussia, and Bismarck had King William I crowned as head of the German Empire. Germany was now on its way to unification, and a world power, nevertheless, minus the Germans of Austria. Despite all the time that Germany had lost, while the other great nations of Europe were acquiring colonies, Germany was now a world power to be reckoned with, and was unquestionably becoming Europe's strongest nation and its leader. Despite the paramount credit given to Bismarck for uniting Germany, he never came to grips with the Jewish problem as such, and the Jewish power and influence in Germany remained unchecked and unmitigated. Nevertheless, the power and productivity of the German people became manifest. And if there is anything that the Jews did not want, it was that the fine qualities inherent in the German blood should come to the fore and assume leadership of the white race. With the propaganda control in their hands in Germany, in France, in England, and the other countries of Europe, as well as the United States, and with the national hatreds being continually kept alive and fanned with propaganda at will, the Jews were successful in plunging Europe into what is known as the First Great World War. Other things being equal, and had both sides been devoid of Jewish power and influence, Germany might have won that war, and in fact, was on her way to doing so. This was not to be, however, since the Jews did not want Germany to win. They did not want a strong white leadership such as the Germans offered. The Jewish control of Germany, even during World War I, was almost complete. The Minister of Production was a Jew. In fact, the whole German government was thoroughly riddled with Jewish bureaucrats, and in the spring of 1918, as Germany was pushing forward a victorious campaign to end the war, the Jewish conspiracy brought about a munitions strike at home and sabotaged the whole German war effort. With the propaganda reins firmly in their control, the Jews then organized a communist revolution in the heart of Germany, while the brave German boys were dying in the trenches. The end was not too far in coming. By November, a betrayed and Jew-ridden Germany sued for peace, while her brave soldiers at the front were still far within enemy territory. One of those brave soldiers, who had been disabled by a poison gas attack, was blind and in a hospital at the time the armistice was announced, was an unknown corporal by the name of Adolf Hitler. He tells his reaction when he heard the shattering news of Germany's defeat. "Since the day when I stood at my mother's grave, I had not wept. When in my youth, fate seized me with merciless hardness, my defiance mounted. When in the long war years, death snatched so many a dear comrade and friend from our ranks, it would have seemed to me almost a sin to complain. After all, were they not dying for Germany? And when at length the creeping gas, in the last days of the dreadful struggle, attacked me too, and began to gnaw at my eyes, and beneath the fear of going blind forever, I nearly lost heart for the moment. The voice of my conscience thundered at me, 'Miserable wretch, are you going to cry, when thousands are 100 times worse off than you?' And so I bore my lot in dull silence. But now I could not help it. Only now did I see how all personal suffering vanishes in comparison with the misfortune of the fatherland." He broke down and cried. There followed terrible days and even worse nights. I knew that all was lost. Only fools, liars, and criminals could hope in the mercy of the enemy. In these nights, hatred grew in me, hatred for those responsible for this deed. There is no making pacts with Jews. There is only to be the hard, either or. I, for my part, decided to go into politics. Who was this man? Adolf Hitler? This outstanding genius of the white race, probably the greatest leader the white people have ever had, came from a very inauspicious beginning. He was born of parents in the lower middle class in a small town on the border of Germany and Austria, but on the Austrian side. It was called Braunau am Inn. The date was April the 20th, 1889. During his school years, young Adolf showed a penchant for being a leader amongst his schoolmates. He also displayed an avid interest in history and a strong leaning toward nationalism and loyalty to his own race. He was also blessed with a strong inclination in the artistic fields. By the time he was 12, young Adolf had decided he wanted to be an artist, and plainly told his father of his desire. His father strongly objected to his choice. The conflict that ensued between the two was resolved by his father's death when young Adolf was 13 years old. The family was now in rather dire financial straits, but his mother managed to send him to technical school in Linz. Here his talents for drawing and architecture became obvious. It was also during this period that Hitler developed a strong feeling for German nationalism and a strong feel for historical thinking. He says, "The habit of historical thinking, which I thus learnt in school, has never left me in the intervening years. To an ever-increasing extent, world history became for me an inexhaustible source of understanding for the historical events of the present. In other words, for politics. I do not want to learn it. I want it to instruct me. When Hitler was 18 years old, he went to Vienna to try to begin his professional training towards becoming a painter and artist. He took the required examination at the Vienna Academy of Fine Arts. To his great surprise, he found that he had failed these examinations. The professor who had examined his drawings informed him that his talent lay not in the field of painting, but in the field of architecture. His interest in architecture had been growing steadily in the last few years, but he now realized that in order to take up professional studies in this field, he lacked the necessary educational background. It was not long thereafter that his mother died, and he was now an orphan faced with the problem of making his own living. Somehow, he had to make a living. He had no trade or training in any particular vocation. His future looked bleak. Nevertheless, bidding his relatives farewell, he declared that he would go to Vienna and never return until he had made good. With a suitcase full of clothes and underwear in my hand, and an indomitable will in my heart, I set out for Vienna. I, too, hoped to wrest from fate what my father had accomplished 50 years before. I, too, hoped to become something, but in no way a civil servant. The next 4 years, between 1909 and 1913, turned out to be a time of utter misery and destitution for the strong-willed young man from Linz. These were his most formative years, and the years in which he learned the bitter lessons of life from the school of hard knocks. It was in the metropolitan city of Vienna, 10% of whose population at that time was Jewish, that Hitler also began to learn the facts of life, about the powerful stranglehold the Jews had on that city in particular, and world influence in general. He became a voracious reader and read the daily press intensively. It was during this time also that he gained a keen insight into politics and began to detect what the slimy hand of the Jew behind the facade of communism was doing to the German people. He said, "Vienna was and remained for me the hardest, though most thorough, school of my life. I had set foot in this town while still half a boy and left it a man, grown quiet and grave. In this period, there took shape within me a world picture and a philosophy which became the granite foundation of all my acts. In addition to what I then created, I have had to learn little, and I have had to alter nothing." It was also during this time that he thoroughly studied and learned the poisonous effects of the social democracy movement in Austria, which was a disguised name for communist Marxism. He says, "I understood the infamous spiritual terror which this movement exerts, particularly on the bourgeoisie, which is neither morally nor mentally equal to such attacks. At a given sign, it unleashes a veritable barrage of lies and slanders against whatever adversary seems most dangerous, until the nerves of the attacked persons break down. This is a tactic based on precise calculation of all human weaknesses, and its results will lead to success with almost mathematical certainty." After 4 years in Vienna, the most dismal years of his life, Hitler left that city for good and moved to Munich in the spring of 1913. He was glad to get out of Vienna. which he called a cosmopolitan racial Babylon. He felt much more at home, both spiritually and politically, in Munich, since his strong pro-German nationalistic feelings were much more in harmony here than in the Austrian Empire of polyglot races. Hitler was, at this time, 24 years old, and to everyone except himself, he must have seemed a total failure. He had no friends, no family, no job, and no home. He had, however, one thing, an unquenchable confidence in himself, and a deep, burning sense of mission. He also had an intense and abiding love for Germany and the German people. Nobody at that time could have foreseen the tremendous mission that Adolf Hitler was destined to fulfill in his newly adopted land of Germany. When war broke out in August 1914, he immediately, on the third day of August, petitioned King Ludwig III of Bavaria for permission to volunteer in a Bavarian regiment, and it was granted. Of this historic turning point in his life, Hitler says, "To me, those hours seemed like a release from the painful feelings of my youth. Even today, I am not ashamed to say that, overpowered by a stormy enthusiasm, I fell down on my knees and thanked heaven from an overflowing heart for granting me the good fortune of being permitted to live at this time. A fight for freedom had begun. This time, not the fate of Serbia or Austria was involved, but whether the German nation was to be or not to be. During the 4.5 years Hitler served in the infantry, he was wounded twice and received the Iron Cross, second class, at one time, and the Iron Cross, first class, the second time. We have already related how at the end of the war he had been gassed and blinded and received the bitter news of the treachery and defeat perpetrated on his beloved fatherland. It is tremendously important to here recount the tragedy, humiliation, and destruction that was now heaped upon post-war Germany. After the infamous stab in the back that she received on the home front from a munition strike, a strike that was organized by the Jewish clique in the very heart of the German front, she was further humiliated, crushed, and destroyed. With Germany crushed to the ground, the Jews then saddled her with a bitter and vengeful Treaty of Versailles, a treaty written and dictated by the Jews so as to enchain Germany for the next 100 years. The fruits of her labors would be plundered by the victors, and particularly by the Jewish international clique. Upon Germany, the Versailles Treaty imposed harsh, dictatorial, and draconian peace terms. All of Germany's holdings, her colonies, and her territories were taken away from her and divided up amongst other nations, with Great Britain becoming the prime benefactor. The German traitors, who now were the representatives for Germany at the peace table, were made to sign the statement claiming full responsibility for starting the war, and that the war guilt rested upon Germany and the German people. A fantastic reparation sum was imposed upon Germany, a sum so huge that it was equivalent to about 3 times the net worth of all of Germany put together. In order to pay this and the interest on it, the Germans would be enslaved and in bondage forever and a day. But the shame and humiliation heaped upon Germany, the reparations, the lost colonies, and the war guilt were only a part of the dire tragedy that now engulfed Germany. At home, the Germans were leaderless and helpless, with Jews, revolutionaries, and traitors heading up their makeshift government. The rapacious Jew then swarmed in from all parts of the world to loot, plunder, and dismember the German Reich, and to perpetrate revolution and destruction upon the helpless people. In the period immediately following World War I, Germany and its heroic people reached an all-time low. Misery and wretchedness, hunger and privation, distress and confusion were rampant throughout the land. Millions upon millions of German people were without work and starving. Thousands died daily of hunger. At the same time, the Jews were supplying funds to communist revolutionaries to destroy Germany from within and take it over completely. Jews came in with money from all parts of the world, money they had plundered and stolen from other countries, and rushed into Germany and bought up all the starving German people's property, hotels, restaurants, manufacturing plants, and even their homes were bought up by the Jews for a few cents on the dollar. In order to survive, the starving German people had no alternative but to sell their properties, worth a fortune, for a fraction of their real value to these Jews, just in order to obtain enough money to eat. In order to realize just how terribly desperate the conditions in Germany were at this time, it is necessary to go into further study of this deplorable post-war era. These, our white brethren, were literally living out of garbage pails in order to survive. Jews owned all the businesses. They had stolen these from the Germans for mere pennies. They had all the good food, all the medical facilities, and the German people were allowed nothing. Many Germans, walking the streets, would stand in front of restaurants, the same restaurants that they themselves formerly owned, and would look inside, hunger eating at their insides. The Jews would sit in the windows of these restaurants, eating food and delicacies, while the Germans were eating garbage. With their usual arrogance, the Jews would hold the food up in front of the Germans looking through the windows, laughing at them, making fun of them, anything to disgrace them further. There seemed nothing that the German people could do to rectify this at that time. The control of the police and the courts in Germany were firmly in the hands of the Jews themselves. The Germans could obtain no justice in the courts whatsoever. Jobs were available only to those Germans who would not speak out, but bowed down to the communist Jewish overlords. Filthy literature was rampant on the newsstands, and young children even were subjected to this type of degradation, something that is now happening right here in America. Newspapers, magazines, lewd movies, obscene literature of all types were prevalent everywhere. However, no one was allowed to speak out against the Jews. German women were manhandled in the streets, and if they complained, they were arrested by the authorities. Schools and colleges were infested with communist Jewish professors. All these tragic manifestations, and many more, that we are facing in the United States today, Germany was totally engulfed with in the period from 1918 until 1933. Unless you worked with the Jews for the destruction of the white German race, you were boycotted, prevented from obtaining employment, and even from obtaining enough food to sustain life for yourself and your family. The courts were completely corrupted and in the hands of the Jews. No decision was ever handed down unless the Jews approved of it, or they themselves made it in the first place. Even the one-time wealthy businessmen who had worked all their lives to build their businesses honestly, were deprived of them by the Jews. Many of them were made to work as common laborers, if they were lucky, in the same plants that they had once owned. Conditions were so pitiful and so deplorable that despair clutched at the heart of the German people. White German men and women went to bed at night hungry and starving, praying for a true loyal leader from their ranks that would be able to deliver them from this Jewish nightmare. Their prayers were answered. A great man did arise from out of their ranks to lead them out of their misery. His name was Adolf Hitler, the same lowly, blind and unknown soldier who had cried in his bunk in the army hospital when the treacherous betrayal and armistice was announced on November the 11th, 1918. Shortly after the armistice, a very small group had formed a political party in Munich. They called themselves the German Workers' Party. They only had 6 members. Their problem seemed overwhelming, and their future seemed hopeless. It so happened that in 1919, this unknown soldier attended one of their pitiful meetings. His imagination told him that somehow something meaningful could be done with this small beginning. He joined the party and became party member number 7. With his great speaking eloquence, undiscovered till now, Hitler began to whip this group into shape. In 1920, the party was renamed the National Socialist German Workers' Party, called Nazi for short. During the next 3 years, from 1920 until 1923, Hitler and his loyal followers managed with great success to awaken the German people to their racial heritage and their great historic past. We must remember that at this time, Germany was rent from one side to the other with communist revolutionaries, Bolsheviks, and other Jewish stooges that incited confusion, treason, and dissension throughout the land, tearing the German nation apart. In order for Hitler and his loyal followers to even so much as hold a meeting, they had to battle the communist goon squads to keep their meetings from being broken up. A goodly part of his party organization had to be devoted to fighting with their fists if necessary, in order to defend their right to speak and their right to hold meetings. This division, called the Stormtroopers, was completely weaponless and had to rely on their fists in order to defend their party's existence. Despite all the precautions they took, hundreds of thousands of them were killed and assassinated in their struggle to save the German race from destruction. By 1923, the Jews had perpetrated the most treacherous inflation in history upon the German people, and it took billions of marks just to buy a loaf of bread. The Jews raped Germany financially and morally. Their Jewish cousins in America swarmed in, and for next to nothing, bought up gold watches, apartment buildings, houses, real estate, and completely plunder the German people. It was at this time that the Nazi Party felt that something more desperate had to be done to save the German nation from complete ruin. In November of 1923, they staged a putsch in Munich to take over the Bavarian government, but it was doomed to failure. The Jews still had control of the German army and the militia, and they crushed this attempted takeover in short order. 16 loyal party members and white heroes were killed in this attempt to save the German Reich. Hitler escaped death and was saved for a greater destiny by a merciful providence. He was brought to trial in some of his speeches in defense of his party, he gave some of the most eloquent oratory that had ever stirred the German people. Nevertheless, with the Jews being in complete control of the courts, he was sentenced to 5 years in the penitentiary of Landsberg due to the tremendous pressure from the German people themselves. He was finally released on December 20th, 1924, after serving 9 months. In many respects, this was a blessing in disguise. Because of it, for the first time in his life, Hitler had time to devote himself to setting down the creed and objectives of the Nazi Party. This was compiled in his 2-volume book known as Mein Kampf. The principles embodied in that classic are to this day a shining beacon pointing the way towards the liberation of the white race. When Hitler was released from the penitentiary in 1924, he found his party had fallen apart, was disorganized and in chaos. The party assets had been confiscated by the courts, and these same courts furthermore had forbidden him to so much as speak in a number of German states. A most difficult task faced him. Imbued with an indomitable will and a burning zeal to resurrect his broken country, Hitler carried on. Slowly, the ban forbidding him to speak was lifted from the different states, and Hitler renewed his efforts to reorganize and build the party with an energy that was almost superhuman. Finally, by January 30th, 1933, his party's efforts were crowned with success, and Hitler became the Chancellor of the German Reich. The multitude of problems that now faced him were colossal and almost insurmountable. He had inherited a country that was completely bankrupt, a country that was saddled with the tyrannical Treaty of Versailles, to an interminable future of slavery and bondage. The German people themselves were divided between the followers of Hitler and the Nazi Party versus the communists, Bolsheviks, and the Jews, who still had unlimited control over all the property and finances of the country. Germany was without colonies, without credit throughout the world. She was completely disarmed in the face of a hostile world that surrounded her small country, which, after all, was no larger in area than the state of Texas. The country was rent with poverty and disillusionment. Over 6 million unemployed had hopelessly been staring towards a bleak future. After 13 years of desperate struggle, the lonely, unknown soldier of World War I not only became the head of the German government, but he became the leader of the German people. Far beyond that, he became the symbol and the leader of all white people throughout the world in their struggle against the Jewish monster. From that time that Hitler came to power in January 1933, a miracle seemed to spread across the land of Germany. In short order, the German people again began to have hope and pride and purpose. With his genius for inspiration, organization, and leadership, within 2 years, while the rest of the world was still wallowing in depression and unemployment, Hitler had completely solved the unemployment problem for the German people. Now everybody was working. Great new superhighways were being built. The average worker began to look forward to owning a home of his own. Working people, who before could hardly afford to own a bicycle, now could afford to own a Volkswagen. Whereas Germany had been completely disarmed and helpless, Hitler again instituted military service, built up Germany's armaments, and made her a nation that was feared and respected by her enemies. The Jews were kicked out of office, out of the courts, and out of government. Racial laws were passed prohibiting Jews from being citizens of Germany. It was no longer tolerated that the Jews take up positions in universities and colleges where they could mislead and pollute the minds of the German youth. Jews were barred from the legal profession. They were barred from positions of leadership in theatres, drama, and culture. They were barred from positions of leadership in banking, in the news media, and in the field of national propaganda. Contrary to the many Jewish lies that have been put out about this period in Germany, the Jews were not physically mistreated, nor were any of them killed, or jailed, or harmed in any way, other than outright criminals. These were treated the same way as any other criminal, including anyone of German nationality. However, with their power shorn, many Jews decided to leave Germany, much to the relief of the German people themselves. Once freed of Jewish domination and Jewish subjugation, the resurgence in Germany was a miracle to behold. In attributing the reasons for Germany's miraculous recovery under Hitler, most of the credit must be given to Hitler's inspirational leadership, also his genius for organization and the German people's ability to produce and create were major factors in their recovery. However, not the least of the actions Hitler took that immediately changed the economic distress in Germany was the fact that he freed the German monetary system from the interest bondage of the Jewish bankers. Hitler's government issued their own German money, money that was not issued by Jewish bankers or backed by Jewish gold. It was backed by Germany's ability to produce. It was not subject to the manipulations of the Jewish banks nor the stock exchange. It was issued without interest, free of Jewish interest and of any Jewish manipulation. This is something no other country in the world enjoyed then, or enjoys now. The very factor was of tremendous importance in the unprecedented recovery that spread over Germany during the 1930s. It is not possible to list the multitude of achievements accomplished during the Hitler era of peacetime Germany between 1933 and 1939. To do so would require many volumes of history. We neither have the space to do so, nor is this our objective in this treatise. I will therefore make a very brief summary, listing some of the highlights during this tremendously productive period in the history of the white race. Upon achieving the reins of power in Germany, Hitler commenced on a political, economic, and social reorganization of Germany by establishing the Nazi Party as the only political party, July 1933, attempting the religious coordination of the Germans, July 1933 and April 1935, regulating the national labor and industry, January 1934, appointing Dr. Joseph Goebbels, coordinator of propaganda and cultural life, and by executing recalcitrant party members and dangerous political opponents in June 1934 purge. Mutinies are suppressed. Hitler warned, in accordance with laws of iron, which are eternally the same. Following the death of von Hindenburg in August 1934, Hitler united the offices of President and Reich Chancellor in himself, and assumed the title of Der Führer, the leader. From 1933 to 1938, Hitler drove the German Jews from most professions, deprived them of positions of leadership in business and sanctioned the Nuremberg Laws prohibiting or regulating domestic relations between Jews and citizens of German or kindred blood. During the course of the revolution, 1933 to 1939, Hitler was able to organize, propagandize, and arouse the youth of Germany to change the national psychology from one of despair to one of confidence in his Third Reich, and to reduce German unemployment by measures which culminated in the four-year domestic plan of September 1936 and a collateral plan for total rearmament. Since he knew that the Jews would make every attempt to arouse the surrounding nations to crush his new Jew-free, thriving German Reich, from the very moment of his rise to power, Hitler commenced an orderly, planned preparation for war, if war should be necessary, to defend his homeland and his people. Nevertheless, he held out the hand of friendship in the hope of peace to his surrounding neighbors, who were now being goaded by their Jewish masters to foment war and hatred upon Germany. Hitler re-established military service in March of 1935 and otherwise scrapped the tyrannical Treaty of Versailles. He proposed peace to the Western powers in May 1935. He reoccupied and fortified the Rhineland and repudiated the Locarno Pact in March of 1936. One of his greatest triumphs was the reunion of his homeland Austria with his fatherland Germany on March the 14th, 1938. The uniting of the German people of Austria and those of Germany had been strived for and yearned for by millions of Germans for many generations. The Anschluss, or political union, of Germany and Austria accomplished. Hitler made a triumphal entry into Vienna, the city that had given him nothing but hardship and heartbreak in his early years. Undoubtedly, when he addressed the German people in Vienna, who went wild with enthusiasm and jubilation, it was probably the greatest hour of Hitler's life. There were still more than 3 million Germans just across the border in Czechoslovakia, in an area called Sudetenland, an area that had been torn from the heart of Germany in the treacherous Versailles Treaty. The Jews now set about persecuting, murdering, and tormenting these 3 million Germans within their clutches. It was a situation that no honorable German could long tolerate. In September the 29th, 1938, the premiers of Great Britain and France and the Duce of Italy were at Munich to hear Hitler's demands for the cession of the Sudetenland by Czechoslovakia. By the middle of October, German troops occupied this area, and another 3 million Germans were united to their fatherland. On March the 15th, 1939, German troops occupied and absorbed the rest of Czechoslovakia. A polyglot of mixed nationalities, formerly a part of the Austrian Empire, but artificially carved into a separate country by the treacherous Versailles Treaty makers. The Versailles Treaty had also far-sightedly laid the seeds for dissension between Germany and Poland by wantonly carving out a huge chunk of land through the middle of East Prussia and ceding it to Poland, thereby cutting Germany in two. We can imagine what this would be like if in our own country, here in America, a huge corridor were cut through the middle of Texas, severing the lower half and ceding this area, for instance, to Mexico. This is what the treacherous Jews had done to Germany in the Versailles Treaty of 1919. Furthermore, since the Jews in control of the surrounding countries now were going all out out to foment hatred and war against Germany, they again applied the same tactics of murder, torture, harassment to the Germans living in the Polish corridor, an area that had for centuries belonged to Germany. Again, the Germans came to the aid of their fellow blood brothers. In keeping with their national honor, they could not sit idly by and see their German brethren murdered, tormented, and tortured just across the border, especially on land that rightfully belonged to Germany. Hitler did his utmost to try to solve this problem peacefully. When he saw that the Jewish-controlled democratic governments wanted to be neither reasonable nor wished any settlement, Hitler gave the Poles an ultimatum. This ultimatum was arrogantly rejected by Poland, and on September 1st, 1939, Germany's Wehrmacht marched into Poland and utterly crushed the Polish forces and their government in a short period of 3 weeks. France and England, then completely controlled by the Jews, as they are in fact to this day, used this excuse to declare war on Germany, the excuse being that they were duty-bound to come to the defense of Poland. The fact that they had no intention of rescuing Poland, and never did, but were solely intent on crushing a Germany which had freed herself from the Jews, was lost upon the rest of the world. We all know what followed. With the means of propaganda and money, the control of government in the hands of the Jews in the rest of the world, including the United States, one country after another was goaded and tricked into declaring war upon the German people. Instead of following the example of the German people and letting them help the rest of the white people free themselves from the Jews, the poor, deluded white people of the United States, England, and France allowed themselves to be used like a bunch of cattle to not only help the Jews destroy Germany and the Germans, but in the end to bring about their own self-destruction. Again, it is not our purpose here to review the history of World War II. It has been reviewed and written and distorted by the Jewish press in 1,000 books and tens of thousands of articles. We all know that Jewish stooges, such as that insane super-egotist Franklin D. Roosevelt and that drunken Zionist agent Winston Churchill, succeeded in lying to their people, tricking their people and goading them into a war on the side that would be to their own worst interests. The German people, with one of the greatest leaders the white race has ever produced, fought bravely and valiantly. Their glorious exploits will forever be engraved in the pages of history where heroism is recorded. Nevertheless, Germany, who had only a short period of 6 years to recuperate from financial, industrial, and spiritual bankruptcy, and a country which in area was only the size of Texas, was able to hold out for 4.5 years before it was crushed by the greater part of the rest of the world, including the vast resources of the United States of America and Soviet Russia. Again, we repeat, it is not our objective here to review the history of the tragic Armageddon, this tragic fratricidal war in which white brother killed white brother, one half struggling for their survival and freedom from under the Jewish heel, the other side under the demented influence of their mortal enemy, the treacherous international Jew. It is rather our purpose here to sketch these events in rough framework, to draw our lessons and conclusions from this review. What lessons can we learn from this powerful episode in history that spanned a period of less than 25 years. For one thing, we can be tremendously proud that the white race can produce such a great and magnificent leader as was embodied in Adolf Hitler. On the other hand, we cannot help but be unabashedly ashamed that so many good white people were too stupid to recognize this great genius in their midst. Secondly, we must bow our heads in shame that the white people were gullible enough to allow themselves to be deluded by the treacherous Jew into destroying their greatest opportunity at salvation and freedom from the miserable world pestilence of Judaism. We can, however, be tremendously encouraged and take heart in the fact that the Jewish power was actually broken within a large area of Europe. In fact, Hitler and the German people came within a hairbreadth of freeing the rest of humanity from the tyranny of the international Jew. Had the hand of fate intervened just a little differently, in a number of circumstances, permanent victory could have resulted on the side of the white man. For instance, had the timing been just a little later, it is not only possible, but very probable, that the German scientists, in a revitalized and energetic Germany, would have perfected the atom bomb before it would have been possible in a decadent and depression-ridden United States. It was only under the inspiration and pressure of war that the United States could rally itself to undertake such a huge project. Had the war been delayed, say for a matter of only 3 or 4 years, it is very possible that Germany would have had the atom bomb first. And if they had had it first, history would have turned out differently and more favorably for the white race, and catastrophically for the Jewish race. Or, had a white leader of similar stature to Hitler arisen during the 30s in the depression-ridden United States, things would have certainly turned out differently for the Jews and for the destiny of the white race. We did have a few leaders that did show some promise, such as Huey Long in Louisiana, who, by the way, was assassinated by a Jewish doctor, or a Charles Lindbergh, who might have led the American people. Unfortunately, Lindbergh did not quite have the spiritual fiber. Or had that miserable, drunken Jewish stooge, Winston Churchill, suffered a demise for any one of a number of reasons during the Battle of Britain, the will of the British people might have collapsed, and with it the war efforts of the enemies of the German people and their fight for freedom. Or perhaps, if the first winter after the Germans invaded Russia in 1941, had not come so unfortunately early and been so tremendously severe, the Germans might have conquered Russia in the first year. Having collapsed Russian resistance, they might have been able to organize the vast natural resources of that country and provided a wide and wonderful base that the rest of the world would then not have been able to crush under any circumstances. Or some other technical invention might have come forth on the side of the Germans, such as the V-2 rockets, that would have given the Germans an early advantage and lead in the war and decided victory in their favor. In any case, it is safe to assume that victory could have just as easily come on the side of the white man fighting for his freedom and turned against the worldwide Jewish conspiracy. The fact is, it almost did, and the last thing in the world the white race must not fall heir to is the idea that the victory over the Jewish international conspiracy is inevitable. It is our manifest destiny to become supreme throughout the world. We must forever keep this uppermost in our mind, with an indomitable determination and an unquenchable passion. The complete victory of the white man is paramount to his survival. For the white man, it is either white supremacy or white extinction. The white man was never created to become a slave to a parasitic race that was never even capable of founding a culture. Today we have overwhelming evidence from the Jews themselves as to what a major threat they view Hitler's racial philosophy. Nearly 30 years after Hitler's death, it is hardly possible to pick up a newspaper without seeing some snide, disparaging lies about Hitler in print. We can hardly turn on a TV set, but somehow, somewhere, an innuendo, an insulting remark is dropped. A hit-and-run attack is made on Hitler. As in that attack on the Romans, the Jews persistently and forever keep attacking and discrediting that which is best in the white race. As a result, even today, Adolf Hitler and the Romans rate more abuse and slander from the Jewish smear apparatus than any other targets. There are, however, some shortcomings in the Nazi philosophy and Hitler's program that we should also recognize and learn our lessons from them. One of the basic weaknesses of Hitler's program was that it was founded almost completely on the narrow base of the supremacy of the German race rather than the all-inclusive supremacy of the white race. History quite clearly shows that the British nation had the will, the energy, and the genius to build the British Empire, an empire which encompassed approximately one quarter of the surface of the earth. We also know that the French nation produced a great outburst of energy and military success under the leadership of Napoleon. It is also abundantly clear that great geniuses were produced in the field of painting by such nations as Holland, France, Italy, England, Belgium, and others. In the field of music, we have great opera geniuses in Italy, such as Verdi, Puccini, Mascagni, and many others. In the field of science, there are a great many white geniuses who have contributed to the field of chemistry, physics, mathematics, invention, and technology from the ranks of the white man, from many nations. In the field of discovery, we have men like Columbus, Captain James Cook, and hundreds of others. In any case, without belaboring the issue, it is abundantly clear that the base should be broad enough to include all the white people in general. While Hitler's appeal was basically directed towards the German people, however, in all fairness to Adolf Hitler, we believe that it was his intention to work for the salvation of the white race as a whole. But unfortunately, in order to get an organized fighting base constructed, he had to first of all organize the German people. He did do this on a partisan basis, which rallied the German people and depicted the British and the French as their past and future enemies. Whether it could have been done in a different way, in the short time that he had to prevent the complete subjugation of Germany to the clutches of Bolshevism, today we can only speculate. In any case, it is deplorable that the heart and soul of the National Socialist philosophy was based on a narrow foundation, primarily encompassing only the German people and espousing pan-Germanism. Ideologically, we of the Church of the Creator part company with National Socialism at this point. We espouse racial socialism, not National Socialism. We believe that nationalism is a divisive idea among the white people of the world, not a unifying force. Like religion, it has been used to split the white peoples of the world for centuries, with wars and destruction ensuing. Not only have the French fought the English, and the English and the French fought the Germans, etc., but during the war between Austria and Prussia, even Germans killed Germans, all under the guise of nationalism. We therefore reject National Socialism and replace it with Racial Socialism. We are not particularly concerned whether a white man is an Englishman, a German, a Frenchman, or a Norwegian. Our common tie is race, not nationality. The Jew for centuries has been completely indifferent as to whether one of their own was of American, English, or German nationality. The common bond is their race and their blood. Their strength has largely been due to their inbred racial loyalty. Nor are we concerned as to whether a white man is Nordic, Aryan, Alpine, or Mediterranean. This too is divisive and would exclude many of our good white brothers. We therefore speak of the white race and never of Aryan, Caucasian, etc. We, too, must think along lines of racial loyalty to the white race. We must never again be caught in the web of nationalism as a divisive wedge used to instigate wars between members of the white race. For this reason, we base our entire creed on racial socialism, not national socialism. This difference is of major significance. In a following chapter, we explore this idea further. The second criticism I have of Adolf Hitler and his program is that it was founded on a political base rather than going all the way and building it on a religious base. Hitler really never came to grips with the problem of Christianity, instead tolerating it and trying to coexist side by side with it. Nowhere has he ever pointed out that Christianity was a Jewish creation, perpetrated upon the white race in order to destroy it. While Hitler tried to live and let live as far as the Christian religions were concerned, they in turn fought him tooth and nail. The Catholic Church, from its worldwide headquarters in Rome, collaborated with the Jews and with the communists and did everything possible to undermine and stymie the German people's fight for freedom against the worldwide Jewish conspiracy. The Protestant Church was no less aggressive and fanatic in their campaign to crush this great racial outburst. Even in Germany itself, the Catholic and Protestant churches fought Hitler every inch of the way and used their moral and spiritual influence in dividing the people and setting them against their government. Even during the critical war period, the church leaders in Germany committed untold acts of treason against their own people and their government when the latter were engaged in a life-and-death struggle. It is overwhelmingly evident that a religion which teaches that the Jews are God's chosen people, that they have a sweetheart arrangement with the Lord, that they are untouchable because the Lord said, I will curse them that curse thee, and I will bless them that bless thee, is completely untenable with a philosophy of white racial supremacy. I therefore believe that Hitler did only part of the job by tackling it from a political and military basis, rather than founding a completely new religion that encompassed and united the whole white race of the world in opposition to the colored races. Also, the fact that he formed an alliance with the Japanese Empire, an empire of the yellow race, is something that undermines the whole concept of white racial supremacy. Again, in fairness to Hitler, perhaps under the pressure of time and expediency, he had no other choice. Perhaps, once he had won the war, and was in firmer control of the resources and the means to carry out further revolutionary changes, he would have come to grips with the churches and their deceitful and hypocritical undermining of the white race. Perhaps he would have, but at that stage, and under those circumstances, he was not able to do so. He did organize the Hitler Youth and inculcate them with a completely new philosophy, mainly of the philosophy of blood, soil, and honor. Certainly the youth, being indoctrinated in the new racial ideas, was not encouraged to go to church. In fact, the timing of most of these meetings conflicted with those which they might have spent in church. The priests and the pastors were violently jealous of the appeal of philosophy of the Nazi Party made upon the youth, and that they were losing the youth to the Nazi Party. Had Hitler won the war, and having had more time, I believe it would have undoubtedly resulted in the demise of the Christian churches and the eventual replacement of that suicidal philosophy with a new and rigorous racial ideology based on the survival and supremacy of the white race. Be that as it may, I am firmly convinced that the survival of the Christian religion and the survival of the white race are incompatible. Either Christianity will survive long enough to destroy the white race, in which case Christianity will be destroyed along with it, or the white race will come to its senses, will shake itself free from the suicidal clutches of the Christian philosophy, and found its own religion, based upon the purity and supremacy of its great racial destiny. I first read Hitler's Mein Kampf in the original German when I was 20 years old. I have reread it many times in the English version. Whereas I believe it is one of the great books of all time, I do not believe that it is by any means the complete answer to the problem of America today in the 1970s. It has many deficiencies. Some of these are: A. It is based on a political rather than a religious approach. B. It emphasizes pan-Germanism rather than the white race as a whole. C. It does not come to grips with Jewish Christianity, a most crucial omission. I have already mentioned these in my review of National Socialism. There are, however, several other factors that make it completely inadequate as a program for the white race of America today. In the first place, the book was written in 1924, almost 50 years ago, in a defeated, war-torn Germany, a country in a much different situation than America today. Whereas the cause of the Germans' problems at that time was the same cause as that of our problems today, namely the international Jew. Nevertheless, our situation is vastly different. Whereas Germany in the 1920s was desperately poor and starving, we in America in the 1970s are, superficially at least, enjoying the greatest affluence in the history of mankind. Whereas Germany was a defeated nation, saddled with a monstrous Versailles Treaty, this has little or no meaning to the average American of today. Yet in a large portion of his book, Hitler is hammering away at the evils of the Versailles Treaty. Hunger and employment were rampant in Germany in the 20s. Today in America, these issues are irrelevant to the average American worker, nor does he even know what the Versailles Treaty was all about. We therefore find that to the average American, Mein Kampf is not only hard to understand, but also hard to read, and does not strike fire. Our problems are vastly different. Whereas, outside of the Jews in their midst, the Germans were racially of one kind. In America, the rising tide of niggers is a frightening and ominous reality that every American is aware of. However, with the Jews, liberals, and communists cranking out race-mixing propaganda by the carload, the average white American is terribly confused about the solution. Then there are many other issues. Vietnam, school busing, welfare to the niggers, crime in the streets, and a host of others that plague the average American today that were different from the German Weimar Republic of the 20s, which is the basis of Hitler's book. Without going into further details, for the above reasons and others, I feel it is not the correct solution to look towards Nazism as the American program to save the white race. We need a more comprehensive, far-reaching ideology that is embedded not only in politics, but in our very religion itself. One that can embrace all the white people of the world, far and beyond the Germans. Furthermore, the stigma the Jew has placed on the swastika and Nazism as such, it is a formidable and unnecessary obstacle to walk up to the door of a prospective member of the Church of the Creator, flashing a Nazi armband. You will be shut out before you even start. How much more receptive would be their welcome if instead you talk to them as representing the interests of their own race, the white race? I therefore conclude that whereas Hitler has made a tremendous contribution to the white race, has shown that a government with a racial base is a great advantage over a polyglot democracy, has exposed the international Jewish network on a worldwide basis, has shown the superiority of the leadership principle. Nevertheless, that neither Mein Kampf nor National Socialism are per se more than a partial solution for the problems of America today and the white race of the world as a whole. We therefore need, and now have, a comprehensive creed, one that embraces the total white race, is predicated on a racial, religious base, and is brought up today to fit the situation in today's foremost bastion of potential white power, America. In any case, we must now build where this great leader left off. We must do it now. We have been given an extra reprieve. And because of the sacrifices and the supreme efforts of this great leader and the German people, we have more time in which to accomplish our goal. In the intervening time, what with the churches having turned completely liberal and having debauched and degraded themselves with race mixing and joining hands with Jewish communism, we now have an excellent opportunity to destroy both these suicidal Jewish philosophies, and build a new religion for the white race. We can thank Adolf Hitler for the extra time that we have been granted. On the whole, there are many things that we can be tremendously grateful for to this, the greatest of all leaders of the white race. He has given us great inspiration and great hope that this Jewish pestilence can be destroyed. He has alerted the whole world to the fact that there is a Jewish menace and that communism is basically a Jewish creation. He has shown the world that the white race too can unite on the basis of racial bonds, and once they have done so, that they can fight like wildcats in defense of their race, their country, and their honor. Hitler has shown the world and history the integral value of race itself, and that race is the basis of all progress, culture, and civilization. He has shown the world the tremendous superiority of the leadership principle over the Jewish democratic process, he has demonstrated its superiority not only in times of war, but also in the tremendous progress that bankrupt Germany made during 6 short years of peace. This remarkable record was clearly demonstrated under the leadership of a white man, in control of the destiny of a white nation, employing the superior leadership principle. He has shown the way to superior organization in the very form of government itself, that is a model for future white governments to emulate. He has forged ahead and given new direction in the field of the arts and culture. Hitler's National Socialist regime can be regarded as the first real government based on racial principles that the white race has ever had. Most people are completely confused about Mussolini's fascist movement and Hitler's Nazi movement. They equate them as being the same, but this is not true. Both of them were based on the leadership principle, and both brought their countries out of the quagmire of Jewish communism. But the significant difference was this. Whereas Mussolini's fascism regarded the state as being the prime consideration, Hitler said that race was everything, and the state was merely a vessel for guarding and advancing the best interests of the race. This is a tremendously important difference, and for this reason, I regard Hitler's Germany as having the first truly racial government the white race has ever had. In summary, we can say that Adolf Hitler has bought us at least 50 years of time in which to overcome the worldwide Jewish network. Without his great struggle, undoubtedly the whole world would now be in the iron grip of Jewish tyranny to the same extent that it is now in Soviet Russia. He has made the whole white race proud of the heroic leadership he gave the German people and the inspiration he imbued them with in their heroic struggle for freedom. He founded a new philosophy which was based on the value of race in a way which it had never before been presented and to an extent which it never before had been promoted. He gave the white race tremendous encouragement that the Jewish conspiracy can be broken and will be broken. For these reasons and many others, we can say without reservations that Adolf Hitler was the greatest leader the white race has ever had and the greatest white man that ever lived. On April the 30th, at 3 p.m., Adolf Hitler was killed in action while defending Berlin from the Mongolian hordes from the east. Contrary to the enemy version, he did not commit suicide, nor did he escape to another country. On May the 1st, 1945, the German radio broadcast the following message. From the Führer's headquarters, it is reported that our leader, Adolf Hitler, was killed in action this afternoon fighting in the line of duty to his last breath for Germany against communism. He did not die in vain. He and millions of heroic Germans died fighting for our cause in order that the white race might survive before the diabolical Jewish onslaught. Not too long before the end, Hitler made this prophetic statement. Somewhere in a faraway place, a Nazi band is playing Dixie and Swanee River. The blood will run in the streets of America and Great Britain. Then my spirit will rise from the grave, and the world will know that I was right. Today, more than a quarter of a century later, the spirit of Hitler is more alive and flourishing in the hearts of millions of militant white racial comrades than ever before in history. With the crimes of the Jews and the niggers becoming more outrageous every day, the white people are fed up and they are ready to fight. They are looking for a leader to take command in the coming battle. From this greatest of white men, we have received the direction and the inspiration. He spoke these inspiring words. When human hearts break and human souls despair, then from the twilight of the past, the great conquerors of distress and care, of disgrace and misery, of spiritual slavery and physical compulsion, look down at them and hold out their eternal hands to despairing mortals. Woe to the people that is ashamed to take them. Hitler has indicated that he and his people have done their part, and the fight will now have to be taken up in the heart of America from here on out. He is holding out his hand to us now, encouraging us onward. Let us ourselves now take up the fight where he left off, and vow to finish it.